Hola and buenos dias. My name is Lucilenia and I am your host of Sex and Sensuality for Church Girls, where each and every episode we deconstruct and decolonize one topic concerning sex that we learned in church. Welcome to episode 2, where today we are going to be deconstructing sexual energy, or as most people would label it as, sexual desire, an emotion or motivational state characterized by an interest in sexual objects or activities, or by a drive to seek out sexual objects or to engage in sexual activities. Now, I would assume that most people would acknowledge at the very least that sexual energy, sexual desire is something that is natural. We all have it to some degree, although there are people who naturally do not desire sex as well, but that still exists on the spectrum of what is natural. For those of us who were raised in church, we likely were taught that desire outside of the institution of marriage is sinful, or better yet, was labeled as sexual immorality. Defending a very particular version of sexual and religious morality has been very important for the Christian church for centuries, probably. We see it today in evangelical churches fighting against anything that has to do with the LGBTQIA+ community. We see it in those same people fighting against and getting our Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. We see it in pulpits across America, across the world, where colonization has become part of the theology of many, many Christian churches, that says that anything outside of the constitution of marriage is a sin. And what church and, according to them, the Bible teaches, that sexual desire is a problem that needs to be solved, and the only solution to that problem is marriage. You know, it's better to marry than to burn. Especially for women, though, because women don't have as much rights as men do, even in the Bible. According to the author Jennifer Wright Nust, in Unprotected Texts, The Bible's Surprising Contradictions About Sex and Desire, though, the Bible does not speak with one voice when it comes to marriage, women's roles, sexy clothes, and the importance of remaining a pure virgin for one's future spouse. According to Genesis, a woman who sleeps with her father-in-law can be a heroine. Visits to prostitutes are also not a problem, so long as the prostitute in question is not a proper Israelite woman. According to the Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, a beautiful girl who enjoys making love can fulfill her desires outside of marriage and still be honored both by God and by her larger community. Sex is a good thing, and sexual desire is a blessing, not an embarrassment. Yet according to Exodus and Deuteronomy, sex is a matter of male property rights. Men can have sex with as many women as they like, so long as these women are their wives, slaves, or prostitutes. But a woman must guard her virginity for the sake of her father, and then remain sexually faithful to one man after marriage. 1 Timothy offers yet another perspective. A woman must marry not so that she can express her desires appropriately, but so that she can become pregnant and suffer the pains of childbirth. God requires women to suffer in this way and has demanded labor pains from them since Eve first sinned in Eden. Nevertheless, other New Testament books argue that the faithful followers of Jesus should avoid marriage if possible in anticipation of a time when sexual intercourse will be eliminated altogether. Could one imagine a more contradictory set of teachings collected within one set of sacred texts? And I know there will be the people, oh, we don't, we overcame the law when Jesus died, so we don't have to look at or consider the Old Testament, which is why she mentions 1 Timothy and then also mentions where Paul is not even advocating for marriage at all, because marriage takes you away from serving God. And you know, so even in the New Testament, there is contradiction on the validity or the importance of marriage and women giving birth and having children versus being in ministry, and nothing should take away from your time, attention, and desire to serve God, even marriage, according to Paul. But yet, pastors and preachers all the time, even till this day, still use the Bible to tell people how they should, if they should, express sexual energy in any way that is outside of marriage. Anything outside of marriage is fornication, sexual immorality. We have to stay away from the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh. And 9 times out of 10, that lust of the eye and lust of the flesh is brought up in relation to sex, to desire, to anything sensual that would bring about pleasure. Why do we still do that? I have, you know, a few theories, one of which it's because that's what's been done, and we are just perpetuating the teachings that we sat under, because that is what's familiar, that is what's comfortable. Another theory is it's about control, because as the reason why I wanted to talk about it is sexual energy is creative energy. When you think about, and I want to be very sensitive when I say this, because I know that not every person has the ability to create children, but it does not mean that just because they do not have that ability in and of their body, whether or not they have all of their organs intact or not, that it still does not represent the creative center of our body spiritually, as above, so below. So stay with me. And nor would I ever insinuate, use that as a metaphor of someone's inability to give birth or create children is directly related to their sin or their attitude. Absolutely not. But I do want to empower us to see that, again, as you will hear me say often, sexual energy, sensuality, pleasure has more than one function. Yes, bodily pleasure. And if that was the only thing that it did for us, that would be enough. God, I thank you. Yes, it would be enough if it was just for the experience that we have in our body to enjoy, to orgasm, all of those things. But I don't believe it does. I believe that, like other things that we experience, there are spiritual connections to it as well. And so if we demonize sexual desire, sexual energy, or put these really hard limits on them and say that it only should be explored and expressed within the confines of marriage, and we make that the standard, then we cannot and do not empower people to be able to tap into that sexual energy and learn from it, use it, transmute it, etc. I struggled with sharing this next quote by Napoleon Hill, because I know that he's controversial, and there's a lot that I read in my research that says he was a fraud and a thief. But even if he is, and definitely very damning evidence is all those things, he, in his book Think and Grow Rich, has been very influential on a lot of people and is still considered one of the, you know, self-help fathers of, you know, at least America, if not the world. But in his book Think and Grow Rich, in the chapter The Mystery of Sex Transmutation, he says, "It may be controversial contention, but sexual energy is the creative energy of virtually all geniuses. There never have been and never will be a great leader, builder, or artist lacking in this driving force of sex. the mere possession of sex energy itself is not sufficient to produce genius. The energy must be transmuted from desire for merely physical contact into some other form of desire and action before it would lift one to the status of genius. Now, of course, I don't necessarily agree with the part where he says that it's not just for merely physical contact, because I do not and will not sit here in judgment of physical contact as if it's some base thing that we do. Because just like we experience trauma in our bodies, we should absolutely experience joy and pleasure in our bodies as well. We were given these bodies to experience the world through our senses. But I definitely agree that just having it isn't producing genius. But knowing how to use that sexual energy to transmute it into other things, into creation and creative things, is what is going to differentiate someone who is operating in their genius and someone who isn't. But here's the thing. As much as, again, if you look it up, the controversy around Napoleon Hill and him being a fraud and a thief, he did not come up with the idea of sexual energy being or transmuted into creative energy. That is actually something that was taken from ancient Hindu practice. According to Master Cho Kuk Sui, and I apologize if I'm butchering the name, in order to transmute sexual energy, we cannot suppress it. The sexual energy in our body is connected to the Swadhisthana chakra. Again, please excuse my pronunciation. And it is used and can be used to transmute into spiritual unity and love, as well as creative energy. When you master your sexual energy, you are able to transform it into divine oneness, intelligence, enlightenment, love, and kindness. It is that connection. It's a portal into other dimensions. It's why in lots of schools of spirituality, you will also learn that having an orgasmic experience, whether by yourself or with someone else, is a really great time to manifest and to speak affirmations, because magic is just about energy. And what amazing energy do we experience when we are having sex and when hopefully we are orgasming? But again, suppressing that sexual energy does not mean that you have mastered it. Unlike what church has taught us, that mastering something means pushing it so far down that we pretend that we don't need it, don't want it, and we have overcome it. That's not mastering our sexual energy. Being completely liberal with our sexual energy also is not mastering it either. The thing is, though, that frequency, that place of alignment for you, for me, is and often will be different. So how you balance and learn to master your sexual energy is likely going to be different than the way that I do it, and vice versa. And that is okay, because we are different people with different experiences, different traumas, different capacities and capabilities. And that's the beauty of being human, is that there is universal human experiences. And even within those universal human experiences, we are still unique individuals, and there is no one like me on this earth, and there's no one just like you on this earth. We are divine expressions of God in our unique presentation of humanity. The throat chakra is also very important when it comes to transmuting sexual energy. If you even look at the vocal cords, you know, your if you ever see images of it, it actually looks like the vagina. Very, very similar. And I do not believe that that is a coincidence. I think that is very intentional on behalf of our Creator. And so when you have that strong, balanced sexual energy where you have mastered it, where you're not suppressing, but you're not being so liberal that you're giving yourself away to anything and everybody. It also means that you have a balanced throat chakra, because your throat chakra represents your ability to communicate, your ability to communicate effectively, not just verbally, but in any way, shape, or form. And creativity, we are communicating via different art forms, whether it's singing, whether it's art, whether it's an invention, whether it's writing, whether it's filmmaking. And those are art-related creative outlets, but in the easiest ones in most people's minds to be able to understand, but we are all creative, even if you're not artistic. Anyone who is a creative, whether it employs them or they do it as a hobby, will tell you that to master your creative genius, you have to have discipline. You may not want to, but if you're going to master your talent, your creative gift, you have to have discipline. And it is the same with mastering your sexual energy. You have to know what is discipline for you. I liken it to athletes. You hear a lot about when an athlete is getting ready for a big fight or the Super Bowl or the finals, where they will practice abstinence as they train as a form of discipline, and never really heard it. And maybe they are aware, maybe they don't, maybe they're not, but also it's understanding like your sexual energy is part of your life force. And so they want to preserve that because they want to use it and they want to have and be at the tip top of their game to be able to perform in their sport at the very best of who they are. And so it's the same thing about life. Again, you don't want to suppress it and never use it, because you're like, well, if that means that my life force is so precious, I'll just never use it and always use it. And it's like, no, that's not balance. That's not mastery. But it's also understanding that if you are in tune with your life, your body, yourself, your spirit, you'll know when there may be times that you will need to be abstinent to preserve your life force. But then you'll also know that there will be other times where maybe abstinence isn't important so much, but you can still use that creative energy, that sexual energy, for creation. The other thing about that is it is also very much connected spiritually to those people who are called to be healers. And that is something that I wish I would have learned a long time ago, because as a young girl who completely believed that, yep, being a virgin until marriage is right because my mother didn't, she had me, and she had my sister and my brother and my younger sister, and she's not married, and look at her life, and absolutely, I'm going to do it different because she didn't, and look at where it got her. Except I was experiencing, one, just natural hormones and desire that you experience as you get older, but then I just knew I had like this sexual energy, and I didn't understand it, especially as someone who wasn't having sex. And if someone in church, instead of just repeating the same old, that, you know, you just got to stay away from it. Subject your sin, your flesh, and put your flesh under subjection, and all those things that they tell us, that it definitely could be and often is a sign that I'm a healer. Now, of course, we don't even use that kind of terminology in church. So maybe not healer, but maybe someone who's anointed, someone who has a gift, someone who is prophetic, you know, again, because if you grew up in church and you know anything about the church, oftentimes the people who find themselves in sexual scandal of some sort are those in the music ministry and those in leadership. And the responses run the gamut, but oftentimes the gossip flourishes because everyone knows what's happening and no one does it, because those people often are the ones who are benefiting the church the most. They are masters of their craft, even if they may not have been able to discipline their sex or are living lifestyles, quote unquote lifestyles. I don't necessarily like that terminology, but lifestyles that the church does not approve of. And maybe they are disciplined in their sex and their sexual energy, but they're having sex outside of marriage with consenting adults. And the church preaches against that, but won't do anything about it again because, you know, this person sings down, plays that organ like nobody's business. And the people come to hear them sing, to hear them play, to hear that person preach. In the more, of course, nefarious side, we have those pastors, priests, etc., who are leading the congregations and are abusing and molesting children. And we look the other way because that is absolutely a perversion, disgusting, and illegal expression of sexual energy and a lack of discipline, amongst so many other things, but we're not going to go down that rabbit hole. But again, we look the other way. We may gossip, but we don't hold them accountable. We absolutely don't turn them into the police, because what often people don't want to talk about, church is a business, almost sometimes more than it is a ministry. And those people and their creative energy, they bring in the money that pays the bills. Until the scandal gets out and it's in the media, we handle it internally. So ultimately, what am I advocating for? Well, several things. One, that we get rid of the notion that suppressing sexual energy is mastery. It is not. And I'll add this in here. Those who think and have convinced themselves that suppressing their sexual energy is holy and sanctified, and then they get married, a lot of times, I've never been married, but what I hear is that you think you get married and now you can do everything, except you don't know how to allow yourself to do it because you've been suppressing it for so long. And I also want to add in there that just because you're having sex, again, does not mean that you are mastering your sexual energy. So even for those Christians who say they believe that they're supposed to not have sex until marriage, but are having sex and then have sex and think, well, now I could just do whatever, and you're just going to have the best sex of your life, and then you don't, for so many reasons. But not having a healthy ideal and mindset around sex, whether it's suppressing it or being liberal or feeling shame or guilt and all the other things, is not mastery. And it doesn't really serve you. To be able to find oneness with yourself and even use that sexual energy to be one with God, because truly I believe that one of the ways that we are closest to God is when we are creating. God created the heavens and the earth. Using that same creative energy that we have been given, have been blessed with, to now create our worlds. Now, you can't tell me that we are not being like God when we are creating. Whether it's creating life through sex or using that energy to create all manner of things that will live on in the people we touch, in the mark we make in the world, in the legacy we leave through that creation. That preaching abstinence and celibacy is not empowering. It's not educational. It does not serve us. As we grow, I can understand telling a child, no, this is not something you do, with maybe little explanation, because they may not understand. But even a child will grow. We have to teach them and give them information so they're empowered to make choices that are in their highest good, versus telling them, no, don't do this. And as most people do, they go and do it anyway. And either we learn the hard way or we don't learn, and we suffer the ramifications of not truly understanding how important and how sacred our sexual energy is, and why and how to use it. It's now time for our church announcement, so govern yourselves accordingly. Today, I'm going to have a little bit of help from Christian A. Smith. He is the host of the podcast Holy Smokes, Cigars and Spirituality, where they deconstruct harmful theology and build beloved community one cigar at a time. Here you go.
Christians idolize the Bible so much that when I critique the Bible, y'all think I'm critiquing God. And you'll never understand where I'm coming from if you don't untether God and the Bible. That's the problem with having a faith that's rooted in the supremacy of the Bible. Because then any flaw that somebody finds in the Bible invalidates your faith. And your identity is tied up in your faith. So when I critique the Bible, you think I'm critiquing God. And that invalidates your faith, which ultimately invalidates your identity. Which is why y'all think I'm the Antichrist. So no, I'm not going to debate you about theology when your foundational belief is that the Bible is perfect. And that's the problem with demanding Bible loyalty without Bible literacy.
I want to add another passage from Unprotected Text by Jennifer Wright Nust on the topic of Bible literacy. She says, aware of the death-dealing potential of commandments like slaves obey your masters, abolitionists like Daniel Goodwin argued that Christianity must be founded not in particular passages, but in general principles drawn from the whole of the New Testament witness. As he put it in 1864, all these negative arguments from the New Testament in favor of the law and practice of slavery vanish away as smoke before the general spirit and tendency of its teaching, which could be boiled down to Jesus' commandment to love thy neighbor as thyself. The Bible was far too dangerous a document to be read simply or simply read. Abolitionists concluded. Instead, proper interpretation required a set of principles that could determine what the Bible must in the end say. For them, that principle was the golden rule. Since one could not love a neighbor and own himself at the same time, Jesus can only have intended slavery to end. With this principle in mind, Frederick Douglass could then declare that abolitionists should press the Bible to their bosoms all the more closely. They should read it all the more diligently and prove its pages that it is on the side of liberty and not on the side of slavery. If the Bible is to remain, as my denomination puts it, the authoritative guide to knowing and serving the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the divinely inspired word of God, and the quote-unquote revelation of the Christian faith, it seems to me that it is time to apply lessons learned during abolition to other passages as well. It is time to stop pretending that read uncritically and out of context, the Bible will set anyone free. Some kind of larger principle like love thy neighbor is required if an ethical compass is to be extracted from the biblical witness. to close out today's episode, I want to read from a book of the Bible that we don't read too often, but it's a beautiful and very sensual passage from Song of Solomon, chapter 2. And I'm reading from the Passion Translation. Arise, my dearest. Hurry, my darling. Come away with me. I have come as you have asked, to draw you to my heart and lead you out. For now is the time, my beautiful one. The season has changed. The bondage of your barren winter has ended. And the season of hiding is over and gone. The rains have soaked the earth and left it bright with blossoming flowers. The season for singing and pruning the vines has arrived. I hear the cooing of doves in our land, filling the air with songs to awaken you and guide you forth. Arise, my love, my beautiful companion, and run with me to the higher place. For now is the time to arise and come away with me. For you are my dove, hidden in the split open rock. It was I who took you and hid you up high in the secret stairway of the sky. Let me see your radiant face and hear your sweet voice. How beautiful your eyes of worship and your lovely voice in prayer. You must catch the troubling foxes, those sly little foxes that hinder our relationship, for they raid our budding vineyard of love to ruin what I've planted within you. Will you catch them and remove them for me? We will do it together. I know my lover is mine, and I have everything in you, for we delight ourselves in each other. Ashe. So, gracias for joining me for episode number 2 of Sex and Sensuality for Church Girls. I am Lou Selenia, and I appreciate you coming and listening and sharing your energy with me on a weekly basis. You can click the link in the show description to sign up for our mailing list and receive a 30-minute free coaching session with me. It's exclusive to my listeners, just as a thank you. I hope to hear from you soon. Be blessed. And if you are listening to this on a Wednesday, I hope to catch you at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, live on Instagram, where we talk about this week's episode. And don't ever forget, be as radiant as the sun. Bye.